You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got a lovely mixed show for you today. In the last in our series, we're taking a break and won't be back until September, but plenty to keep you entertained in the next hour. We'll be talking to Katie Dale. She's our studio guest today, the author of books aimed at readers from toddlers to teens. We've got the final tranche of winners from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. And we'll also hear from Jan Todd talking about her biography of restoration playwright Afra Behn. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But one of the questions we sometimes ask our guests on Bookmark is whether they always wanted to be a writer. That's a particularly interesting question for you because your mother was a writer.
She is, yes. I absolutely blame her for my career choice because when I was growing up, she was writing all the time and I thought it was perfectly normal to make up stories all day long. And so I wanted to be like her. So I was always writing stories and poems, and I actually had my first poem published when I was just eight in a competition, yes, in Cadbury's Anthology of Children's Verse. So that was a great start to my writing career.
Fantastic. And I suppose what she did by normalising it was also show it can be a profession.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the great things about doing school visits, I think, is because children think that authors are sometimes quite removed. They can like sit in their ivory towers writing books all day, and it's not something they particularly aspire to or think they could do. So I think it's really good to go in and meet them so they can put a face to a name and see that you're a real person. And especially because some of my books were written when I was quite young, I think that's really inspiring to them that the books that they're writing now could actually one day be published.
And that it's a proper job. You know,
absolutely.
Lots of people think it's something you sort of do on the side, which for some writers, let's be fair, it is.
Yes, absolutely. Select few managed to make a living out of it. It's a tough life, but it's a fun life.
A fun life. Good. Well, we'll be talking to you about your fun life in just a moment. But we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is Natasha Bedingfield and Unwritten. Why this one?
I think it's great. It's a great analogy between writing and life. And I love how she compares living your life to addressing the blank page, and all the choices are yours. Only you can write your story and live your life, so go for it.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined.
That's Unwritten there by Natasha Bedingfield, the first choice of music today on Bookmark from our studio guest, Katie Dale. Katie's first novel, Someone Else's Life, was published in 2012. It won the Stockport Mad About Books Award and the Oldham Brilliant Books Award. Since then, she's written 12 more. Her latest, The Never-Ending Birthday, was published by Macmillan last month. Katie, that's an incredible rate of writing there. 12 books in 5 years.
Yes, some are shorter than others. I mean, the young adult books are quite long. They're verging on 100,000 words each, but eight of them are quite short. They're about 2,000 words, fairy tale twists for younger children. So that's how.
Is that because of a hunger from the readers for your books and from the publishers?
I guess so. It's also because I like to do a range, really. I think it's really refreshing to chop and change between writing something very edgy and topic-driven and angsty for young adults and then writing a twisted fairy tale that rhymes. It's really a switch of gears and it's as refreshing as taking a break, I think.
Yeah, well, let's talk because you write a range of books for young children and young adults. You span that spectrum. It's
yeah.
Big spectrum.
It is. See, why not? I love the challenge. Each poses its own challenges and brings its own joys. And I really like to try something new.
Do you have a reader? You know, when you're writing in your head, do you picture a reader?
I do. I think part of it is that I still feel like I'm 17 myself. So when I write young adults, I'm really writing for myself. That's the kind of books I like to read in my spare time. I don't read a lot of adult books, actually. But also, writing for the 9 to 12 age range as well, I sort of channeled my inner 12-year-old and find that she's just there as well. So it's quite interesting, quite a psychological exercise.
And what are the elements of a good book for each of those age groups? groups because they have different interests and different levels of understanding.
They do, absolutely. And you have to bear that in mind when you're writing. With young adult books, it's a lot freer and you can be a lot edgier and take more risks, I think. Whereas for the 9 to 12s, you have to be aware that they're a bit younger and more impressionable. And often there are gatekeepers as well, or parents or librarians who might read the books first before allowing the kids to read. So you have to bear that in mind and handle things a bit more carefully. Nothing too shocking or scary or romantic can be in those, unlike the young adult books. And it's quite interesting because in Mumnesia, I had a scene. So the mother loses her memory and thinks she's 12 again. And part of the plot is that the girl's trying to get her parents back together again. So we have this mother who thinks she's 12 trying to get back with a dad who's middle-aged. And I had a near-kissing scene, which I thought was fine. My editor was like, no, you can't have that because she thinks she's 12. This is so inappropriate. I was like, oh, gosh, it didn't even occur to me. So it's, that kind of thing. It's a learning curve. It's really fun.
And for the YA novels, you can be a bit edgier.
Absolutely. You can take more risks. I think YA is a really exciting genre to write in because it's so varied and you can push the boundaries a lot more. And the feedback from teens as well is great.
And in your books, I notice you often deal with those issues of parents separating, as you say, self-esteem, love, sex, death.
Yeah, all those issues. I think you can handle a lot of those issues in the younger books as well if they're treated just a bit more carefully. I think Jacqueline Wilson does a great job of handling really tricky subjects with humour and heart, and I think that's the key. I've tried to emulate her, I think, in handling those big topics, but in a child-friendly way.
And as you've got more experience, I guess you sort of automatically felt where the line is and when you might be crossing it.
Absolutely. My editor's been very helpful with that. But yeah, certainly now it's my second book for 9 to 12, so I've certainly got more of a handle on how to gauge it and how to write things the appropriate way.
Because in someone else's life, the central character's mother dies of Huntington's disease.
That's right, yes. There's quite a lot of big issues in someone else's life. There's genetic illness, there's abortion, teen pregnancy, death, quite some heavy subjects there. But I think teens can handle it, and I think they want to go to those extremes of emotions, and emotional roller coasters are what I love to read in young adult books, and that's what I love to write as well.
Well, I suppose now, particularly with teens and the internet, they are perhaps seeing things beyond their years that maybe they weren't, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, certainly with film and TV, they push the boundaries as well. And also, I think it's really interesting that a lot of adults in their 20s are reading young adult books. So I think that's also had an influence on what you can get away with.
Do you road test them at all? Do you have a little group, a focus group of readers or friends' children that you...
I don't, actually. Maybe I should. My mum reads all my work first and I read all hers first. But apart from her, just my editors and my agent sometimes.
Very reliable.
Yes.
And this is a slight shift for you because you were an actress.
I was, yes. I went to drama school. That was the dream. In fact, I was on tour. I'm playing in Romeo and Juliet, playing Juliet and Viola in Twelfth Night, and I was still writing on the side. And it was the first chapter that I wrote on the side then that I submitted to a competition, Undiscovered Voices, run by the Society of Children's Books Writers and Illustrators, and that launched my writing career. That chapter was published in an anthology, and from that I got a book deal and my career took off. So it was kind of, I was doing both at the same time and now the writing's taken over, but I would like to go back to acting as well.
I was going to say, do you want to go back to the boards? Because Juliet and Viola, they're cracking roles,
yeah.
So you're also very good.
Oh, they're amazing roles. It was a great summer, that one. But yeah, I would very much like to go back to acting as well.
And did you ever do any Afro-Ben?
I didn't, actually, so I'm very interested to hear the interview.
Well, excellent. That's the right thing to say. Because we've got an interview now on Afro-Ben, the book Afro-Ben, A Secret Life, written by Jan Todd. Jan is a former president of Lucy Cavendish College. She's a biographer and scholar of early women writers and has written biographies and studies of Jane Austen, Mary Wollstonecraft, and her latest explores the life and work of the Restoration playwright Afro-Ben, the first woman known to have made a living from her writing. The subtitle of the book is A Secret Life, and I asked Jan why. Was it because Ben tried to keep her life secret, or because it was hard to find out anything concrete about her?
It certainly was hard to find out certain aspects of her life, her early life and the mystery of the marriage. I think those are still, to me, somewhat secret. But it was a period in which people kept their lives secret as well. It was a tumultuous period with endless changes of regime and political influence, And it was incumbent on everybody to keep certain aspects of their past to themselves. So they made masks and they tried to get into each other's masks. So I think that it's a secret life because the period enjoyed masquerade and she was of that period.
Yes, she was a woman living during the Restoration. Was she a woman of her time or out of her time?
Well, I think everybody is of their time. And because she's a great writer, and I think she is, then she is out of her time too. She's complex and enigmatic and equivocal, and we can interpret her in all sorts of different ways. But she is supremely a woman of her time. She lived that period, its success and its excitement. And she was totally involved in the whole sort of cultural movement, the theatre, the excitement of the theatre, women on the stage for the first time. The whole world could be open to different ways of thinking.
She explored the roles available for women, didn't she? And she wrote a lot about sexuality, very frank, in a way that's still quite shocking today.
Mm. One of the interesting things about her is we keep saying she's the first woman writer of this, that and the other. In fact, in some ways, she was one of the first writers. She's the first intellectual writer who is earning a living solely from her pen. And that's sort of true of a lot of men as well. Before that, they had patrons primarily, or they were actor managers. Whereas in this period, Dryden and Ben and several others were people who lived by their pen. And so they wrote for the theatre, they published what they wrote. So she's very sort of special in this period, but she's also very much of it and very excited to try all the genres, all the ways of writing. She's also aware that all writing, because it's in a different era from the past when sort of Shakespeare was around, has to please a public.
And we're talking about her writing, but she was also a spy.
Yes, she was, and I think it informs her writing very much. I mean, she started out as a spy probably in Suriname and certainly in the Low Countries for the government of Charles II. And it was an amazing period because she writes these letters back which give a wonderful picture of her life and her really rather bad spying. You can see her sitting in a sort of pub being watched by everybody. Because one of the things that the court of Charles II did was send a spy, and then they would send other spies to watch their spy to see that they didn't give too much away, and then there'd be others watching them. It was during the war between England and, well, basically Holland. Basically, the English government wanted to know how many sort of English dissidents were over there working against them. And so she was sent there to bring in somebody she'd already met in Suriname, to bring him in as a spy for the government. And she mistook the whole thing, as far as I can see. She kept thinking that he was giving real information, whereas there are records of him actually still being in the pay of the Dutch government. She is sort of wonderful as a spy, because the other spy people spy on her and say she's just sitting there giving it all away, you know, that, and that even the place she's gone to lodge in is actually owned by the Dutch. She's sort of a wonderful figure of somebody who's doing her best but doesn't really know enough, and it's typical of the government that they have done this to her because she's not told who the other spies are, and so she doesn't understand quite what's going on. But it gives her a wonderful entree, I think, into fiction writing, because she writes up pretty clearly what happens to her in some ways, and it does inform her other writings, her plays, her fiction and so on, where everybody looks at everybody, everyone gazes at everybody, and nobody quite knows what to make of anybody else. Everyone gets things wrong, and this sort of multiple perspectives does, I think, come from her period as a spy.
And I don't want to put labels from our day onto her, but would you describe her as a feminist?
Well, I think any woman who believes in sort of intellectual equality of men and women is going to be a feminist, but she's not what we would call, say, an Enlightenment feminist of the sort that, say, Mary Wollstonecraft is. She is too much involved in the difference between men and women for that label. But certainly she's totally a feminist in the sense that she says it's appalling that women who obviously have the same intellectual ability as men do not have their formal education. And she talks about the fact that women are confined to the fulsome jingle of the times, that they don't have the great classics, they can't be allowed to read Homer and Virgil in the original. So she's very grateful to men who do translations so that she can get a bit close to all this. But she feels it. At the same time, she also says that for writing plays, It's the jingle of the times you need. You don't need a lot of pedantry. And in some ways, I think she's a bit like Jane Austen in that. Yes, women have been excluded from male education, but quite honestly, common sense and a bit of intelligence probably carries one further than pedantry and university education.
And in terms of you writing a biography, you've stated that now writing a biography, the lines are blurred, really, between biography, memoir, life writing and fiction, almost.
Well, I think they are a bit more. I mean, I did apologise for the fact that not everything is known and that much I've had to do there is speculation. I think that informed speculation is probably as close as one can get to it. I also don't feel quite as worried about mining the work for biography, for finding repetitions, psychological repetitions, repetitions of interest and fascination in the work across genres that suggest to me at least a smidgen of biography, autobiography.
And she was forgotten a little bit, wasn't she, after her death? She's coming back into favour now, partly in the 70s and 80s. She was sort of rediscovered. But why was that, do you think?
Because of precisely the frankness that you mentioned. She was at the beginning of all this. She didn't know, because she didn't need to know, that women were expected to write with a different pen from men. And so she wrote like a man. I mean, she could see no reason why she shouldn't. And her plays, I think, though a bit more concerned with women's issues, are like the plays by men. They're in the context of Wycherley and Dryden and so on. She was unaware that there should be this distinction, which comes in much later. The Restoration itself is much maligned. It's seen as almost a toxic period of debauchery and libertinism. And by the middle of the 18th century, it's not only Ben, but quite a few of the writers have fallen out of favour. And Ben as a woman, as the culture becomes more concerned to separate men and women, Ben becomes most toxic of all. And you can see that the way she moves out from the culture, her poems, which are really very, very good, were in anthologies. And slowly, as you go through the 18th century, they move out. And the few plays that lasted are rewritten, changed. The libertine becomes not libertine. The woman becomes more virtuous, speaks less, and so on. So you move into a period in which men and women were supposed to be writing in completely different ways. In some ways, of course, it allows women to move forward because they're now taking up this sort of virtuous role, which is something they can make solely their own. But in many ways, there's a huge loss, and with it goes Aphra Behn.
But she's buried in Westminster Abbey.
She was quite friendly with the Dean of Westminster, and she dies just at the moment when the new regime has come in, which would have made her a rather difficult subject, I think. She would not easily have fitted into the world of William and Mary and the Dutch takeover of England. But she did have enough friends in high places to get her there. She had a lot of friends. She was a very gregarious, fun sort of person. People spoke very highly of her. And I find her just charming in all ways. I mean, if I could go back in time, I would so like to have met Aphra Behn.
And so how was it saying goodbye to her when you had to finish the book?
Well, I don't think you do finish, because there's still a lot to know, and I know a lot of other people are working on her now and may find things that I didn't. I don't think I will ever leave her. She isn't readable, so constantly readable as somebody like Jane Austen is, but the idea of her and some of her works absolutely last, and I don't think I will ever finish with Aphra Behn.
And we see her influence today, do you think?
No, because of this real obscureness of her through the 18th and 19th centuries. So that when she comes back with people like Virginia Woolf and Beda Sackville-West, and Virginia Woolf famously says all women should let flowers fall on the tomb of Aphra Behn, because it was she who earned them the right to speak their minds. She didn't appreciate her as a writer. She appreciated her as a pioneer and a woman. And I think we need to go quite a way further to appreciate her as a real major writer. I think there's quite a bit of work to do yet.
And Afraben, A Secret Life by Jan Todd is published by Fenton Press. Our studio guest today on Bookmark is Katie Dale. Katie, Jan there talking about Afraben's feminism or lack of feminism. And I'm wondering for you, because you have female characters, girl characters in your book, whether feminism is an issue? Is that at the back of you want strong girl characters?
Oh, I think strong girl characters are always a great role model for readers, but it's not something that's in the forefront of my mind when I'm writing. I just want to write books that people enjoy reading and gain something from.
And only so people enjoy reading. Are you aiming at girl readers or boy readers? Because it's notoriously difficult to get the boy reader, isn't it?
It is notoriously difficult to get the boy readers, which is one of the reasons why my latest book has a boy character as a twin. They're twins, so there's equally male and female perspectives, in a hope that those boy readers will not be put off.
What feedback do you get? Because I know you do a lot of school visits. What feedback do you get from boy readers at schools?
They like reading, but they do stick to their boy-driven books with the blue covers. They won't read anything pink. Apart from occasionally, I've done some school visits with Mumnesia, and I was so thrilled with when the boys come up with a sparkly pink cover and they want it signed to them. And it just makes my heart sore when that happens, because it's so rare. A book is a book, and it should be enjoyed by all readers, I feel.
Well done, Katie. Little steps.
Yes, we're
getting
it.
There. We'll listen to your second choice of music now, which is Cher. And If I Could Turn Back Time, why this one?
This applies to both Amnesia and The Never Ending Birthday. They're all about chance to redo things, and I played it a lot whilst writing both books, and it's a great dance number too.
If I could find a way, I'd take back those words that'll hurt you, and you'd stay. I don't know why I did the things I did. I don't know why I said the things I said. Pride's like a knife, it can cut deep inside. Words are like weapons, they wound sometimes.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest in Bookmark today is Katie Dale. And Katie, you're going to read for us now.
I am, yes. So this is an extract from my latest book, which is called The Never-Ending Birthday. And a little bit of backstory. So 13-year-old twins Max and Annie have had the worst birthday ever. Max got hit in the head by a football by his rival Jake Kane, and when he threw it back, Jake dodged it and broke a window, which Max now has to pay for. And then he missed a vital goal in the school football match and lost the match, and it's just the worst day.
It's making me feel better about some of my birthdays.
Yes, it's a very, very bad day. His twin Annie had the worst birthday party ever and was dumped by her best friend and grounded by her parents. So that night, the twins decided to make a wish to redo their birthday, and now it's the following morning. It's dual narrative, so we start off with Max. Heads up! I look up just as a football smacks into the side of my head. Ouch! Not again. Sorry, mate, a familiar voice calls, and sure enough, there's Jake Kane jogging over. Think you're funny, do you? I yell angrily, scrambling to my feet. Stupid, smug idiot. Whoa, Maxine, don't get your knickers in a twist. It was an accident. Two mornings in a row? Yeah, right. Chuck my ball back, mate. Yeah, right. So you can dodge it and make me break another of Mrs. McCready's windows? I don't think so. Jake frowns. Mrs. Who? You broke a window? Ben gasps, eyes wide. When? Where? What? I frown. Yesterday? Right there? Ben and Jake look where I point. But amazingly, the window's now intact. Oh, she must have had it fixed already. Great. Emergency window repairs are bound to cost even more. Think you better get your eyes tested, mate, Jake laughs. And you're going to need better reflexes than that to beat us in the match later. I freeze. What's he talking about, Ben? What match? Ben raises an eyebrow. How hard did that football hit you? The cup final, of course. What? My heart lifts. Are we having a rematch? We need a first match first, Ben laughs. Are you feeling okay? You're looking a bit pale. Here, chocolate always makes me feel better. He passes me another king-sized chocolate bar, just like he gave me yesterday. Sorry, didn't have time to wrap it, he says. Happy birthday anyway. My head snaps up. What? My heart beats faster as I look back at Mrs. McCready's window. It isn't broken. The cup match is tonight. There's only one possible explanation. Yes! It's my birthday! I cry. I was right. Our wish did come true. Did you forget? Ben gasps. Oh my gosh, did that knock on the head give you amnesia? No, the opposite, I laugh. Ben, you will never believe what's happened. Annie and I both had a terrible day yesterday, so last night we wished on our birthday candle that we could do it differently. And when we woke up today, it was today, again, yesterday. It's magic. Ben frowns. Is this one of your pranks, Max? No, honest. Prove it. What? Tell me something that's going to happen today. He folds his arms. Okay, I think fast. The Year 8 maths test is really hard. Ben snorts. Duh. If this is a joke, Max, it's really not funny. It's not. Scout's honour. You're not a scout, Max. Well, no, but Annie was a brownie. You believe her, right? Even if you don't believe me. Well, yes, Ben says. Annie's a very honest person. Come on, then, I grin, grabbing his arm. Now we switch to Annie. Annie! I turn, surprised to see Max dragging Ben down the road towards me. Annie, our wish came true. 5 minutes ago, Jake taunted me about the cup final today, and Mrs. McCready's window isn't broken anymore. Annie, it's still our birthday. Oh my gosh. My heart beats fast as I desperately try to make sense of what's happening. And fail. I can't believe it. How is this possible, Max? How can it still be our birthday? I don't know, he laughs, but it doesn't really matter, does it? The point is, we're here, yesterday, today I mean, our birthday, again! The question is, now what do we do? What do you mean? I frown. We have to go to school and sit that awful maths test all over again. Ben groans. No, we don't, Max argues, his eyes twinkling. Think about it. Today is a gift. It's literally the present. We need to make the most of it. I nod. You're right. So, let's skip school, he cries. All three of us. What? I stare at him. Max, we can't. Why not? Come on, we've already taken the maths test and all of today's lessons. Sitting through them again would be a total waste of our do-over day. No, it wouldn't, I argue. That's the whole entire point of a do-over day. We get to do things better. We can try to get higher marks on the maths test and not get into trouble. Max rolls his eyes. Seriously? Yes, seriously, I retort. Fine. Max throws his hands up in frustration. Do what you want, but Ben and I are going to bunk off. We're going to have some fun.
Oh, if only. If only we could do
that. Wouldn't that be fun?
Two things strike me listening to you read that. One is that your dramatic background must come in very useful when you're reading and doing readings at schools.
Yeah, it's great. I love reading out loud. I think that's definitely a bonus, and doing all the voices. I think it's great fun.
And I wonder if it also helps you with the dialogue, because the dialogue in all your books does zip off the page.
It is the first thing that comes to me. I think, like, my background of reading scripts, of acting, I think in scenes. And so literally I will write pages and pages of dialogue and have to go back later and fill in all the description.
And it just sounds very realistic and lifelike.
Thank you very much.
How you get into the head of a 13-year-old boy or girl? Well, how do you get into the head of a 13-year-old boy or girl?
Actually, it came quite easily. I think it's just, you know, it says something about me that I slip into the mind of a 13-year-old quite easily. But yeah, and it's so fun to write Max and Annie because they're like chalk and cheese, and it's so nice to get the differences, and also later on in the book to see how they rub off on each other and gain some of the other's traits in order to save the day.
And that dual narrative, the multiple perspectives, is something you employ quite a lot.
It is, actually, yes. And three of my books now have been dual narrative. I think I really enjoy doing it. I think it's really interesting to see two sides of an argument, for example. And I think it gives a deeper experience. Often when I'm reading books with dual narrative, I'll be reading one viewpoint and say, oh yes, I totally agree with that character, of course, they're right. And then it switches to the other viewpoint. I was like, oh, I didn't think about that or see it that way. And I think it gives a more rich experience for the reader as they can see the whole story and the whole perspective and make their own decisions about who's right and who's wrong.
And what I really liked is you also give us the perspective of the parents sometimes.
Yes, I do. In Momnesia, that was particularly fun, especially as she starts off being a grown up and then reverts to thinking she's 12 years old. So her narrative in itself changed quite a lot within the book.
Well, you see it, first of all, from the view of her child.
Yes.
Of Lucy. Yes, yeah. Lucy, of mum being grumpy. And then you realise what's going on in Mum's Day.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what that whole book's about, is about the cross purposes of mother and daughter. And then through the book, beginning to see the other person's point of view and understand what's really going on in their life and why they act the way they do and coming to a resolution together.
But I wonder if that's really interesting, intriguing and enlightening for a child reader to suddenly think, well, you know, actually, Mum has issues going on as well. She's not just there to cook food and put me to bed. You know, she has a life.
I hope so. I hope it opens a lot of readers' eyes into, like, what their mums go through and also what they were like when they were 12. I've had some readers come back to me and their mums have come up to me and said, my daughter's been reading this and looking at me very strangely, and she keeps coming up and saying, what were you like when you were 12, Mum? Were you like this? Would we have been friends? And I think that's a really interesting conversation to start, because you can often think that someone was born a grown-up, basically, especially when you're a child. You think Mum's always been Mum, but to then realise actually once she was your age, and would you have got on, would you have had the same interests, and what would the dynamic have been there? I think that's really fun and really interesting.
And getting that feedback now, that must be a gift. I mean, social media is such a gift for a writer.
Oh, absolutely. And Twitter and Facebook, and just getting the feedback straight away from readers, it's priceless. It's really valuable, I think.
And they're very happy to engage and can probably give you story ideas as well.
Oh, yes. Lots of story ideas. That's great.
Well, let's hear from some more young voices now. We've been working our way through the winners and runners-up of the 2016 Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition, and we've reached the final tranche today. The theme of the competition was location as inspiration. Entrants were invited to submit prose or poetry about a place in Cambridge. Cambridge by Sophie Green was a winner in the 12 to 16 year old category. Visit Fitzwilliam by Alif Sektir was a runner up in the 7 to 11 year old category. But we'll start with Vinery Park by Marie Vallier, which was also a winner in the 12 to 16 year old category.
I sit there lost, looking ahead, wondering about the life that I had led. Sitting upon a tree with the breeze blowing gently across my face, I smiled and retraced my life that I had lived. The park was full of memories. Sometimes I wondered how it would be to stay frozen as a figurine, seeing people pass by and watching children grow and say goodbye. It could be for better or for worse, but the park would stay, with the trees collecting the memories, and observe. The children would grow up and come back one day. They would smile and let all the memories fly back this way, remembering the sorrow, the love and the happiness, or even the frustration, hope and angriness. But they would smile with their hearts pounding, remembering their childhood. Slowly leaves fall around me, red, yellow and green they could be. The oak tree in the middle of the park was the place where I would watch, even in the dark, the joy of children bringing back happy memories that I had hidden behind responsibilities. There you would find me at any time of day, hidden behind the leaves, I would stay. And deep down into the park, you find wilderness and amazing creatures, with birds that fly high and soar through the sky, and trees that are always a challenge to climb, with only the best able to overcome them. My memories were coming back slowly. The first time I went to St. Philip's Primary School, and how I looked so minuscule. The wanting to go to the park every day, to laugh and to play. I remembered making new friends and the secrets I would give away, or arguments that came to an end. They and I would grow, a few years would pass, and I would leave my class to go to Netherhall. When growing, you gain more freedom, but along with it there are responsibilities that choke you, but have amazing memories. The first year is hard to adapt to, but soon I made friends I'll never forget, but keep through the whole of my lifetime. I find my freedom through music, and it helps me drift away in my own little world. It helps me surmount the impossible homeworks that are set by thinking of my dream world. Here I am, a few years later, in year 9, stressing out with GCSEs, working hard, but having fun with my friends here at Vinery. But I haven't shown them my place, my own space. It is my secret garden where my childhood will remain. Vinery Park is the place to go when I have nowhere else to go. Vinery is my place to dream, to cry or to share. Vinery Park, just down my street, is the place to go. With the breeze against my face, I climb down, taking it all in, and retrace the life that I have led, and promise the park that I will never forget. Never forget this place in Cambridge named Vinery Park.
If you were to go to Cambridge one day, I'd advise you to go to Trumpington Street. There, you will find the Fitzbillies tea rooms. Once you've seen it, there is no point walking away, is there? Especially if you're hungry. Walk in, and you will find a young lady smiling at you. She'll lead you to your table. After being flabbergasted at how much you can eat, slowly get out of the warm and honeycomb-scented cafe. It will be the slicing chill of the autumn wind that wakes you up from your sweet dream. If you're lucky enough, you'll see the grey tabby cat sitting on the tea shop stairs to keep warm. Now, for the real thing. Why are you stopping? No, walk on. You will know where to stop if you're going to the Fitzwilliam Museum, because it's easily the most grand and attractive building on Trumpington Street. Step into the Fitzwilliam Museum and ask the gentleman where the landscapes are. He will grin widely, point a clumsy finger and tell you to take a sharp left, blunt right, up the stairs, along the corridor, and they are right in front of you, ma'am, he'll announce, and lift his purple hat just enough for you to see his bald head. Once you enter the room, look at the picture closest to you. Look at it. Observe every little bit of it, and before you know it, you'll find yourself in the landscape. Don't be afraid to close your eyes. You'll hear trees' leaves whisper secrets that nobody has ever solved to each other. Open them. You're standing in front of a little hill. There is a fine wooden fence in front of you, and behind it, fields of new-mown hay. Hundreds of kilometers away, the mountains meet the sky. They yell greetings to each other, for this is how the wind passes by. The clouds, however, are chubby ghosts. The light spring breeze will chill you out, though it does start tickling after a while. And if you're lucky enough to go on the right day, you'll get to smell the magnificent trace of nature after rain. You might even hear the dazzling chords of hollyberries if you go near Christmas, or the birds chirp legendary melodies if you go at summer. Whatever you do, if you were to come to Cambridge one day, come to the Fitzwilliam Museum.
Broadcasting from the University City,
we are Cambridge 105.
In Cambridge times, in Cambridge night, in Cambridge spring, in Cambridge light, as birds arrive so swift in flight, swoop over Cam to our delight. As spring gives way to summer's hue, the flash of oars, the fresher's crew, the cry of cocks for Cambridge blue, the wake of learning for the privileged few. The days grow short as summer dies, the cool of dawn, the rain-washed skies. The light shines gold, still melts our eyes. the bridge of Cam, the bridge of sighs. The cycles turn as winter whirls, the woolly tights of Cambridge girls. The term of time once more unfurls, like Christmas lights, like strings of pearls. Cambridge blue, now white with snow, illustrious stars, like footlights glow.
And that was Cambridge by Sophie Green, which was read by Izzy Rees. Visit Fitzwilliam by Elif Sektir was read by Flaviana Cruz. And Vinery Park by Marie Vallier was read by Helen West. We're coming to the end of our time with our studio guest on Bookmark, Katie Dell. Katie, it amazes me listening to these works by young writers. They're astonishingly creative, aren't they?
So beautiful. I was so impressed with those. They're really emotive and you can really feel like you're there. I think they're fantastic.
And some of the images, chubby ghosts, clouds as chubby ghosts, wonderful.
Brilliant.
Now, we've been talking primarily about your books today and your latest, let's just say, Neverending Birthday, published by Macmillan Press. But you've also written 7 in the Fairy Tale Twist series. Tell me about those.
Yes, 8, in fact.
Oh, I miscounted.
So each of the Fairy Tale Twists are rhyming and illustrated with black and white illustrations by the fantastic Matt Buckingham. And most of them will take a fairy tale villain, for example, the big bad wolf or the wicked stepmother, and tell their story. So exonerating them from everything they've been charged with. It's another kind of point of view exercise,
I think, isn't it?
To claim their innocence and how they've been miswritten in the past in the traditional fairy tales. And again, give kids another perspective on things and how they might be really.
And fairy tales, there's a lot in there, isn't there? You get lots of psychoanalytic books about fairy tales. Have you found that?
Yes, absolutely. They're very rich in material. And the great thing about them is that children grow up with them. They're very familiar with the traditional tales. So if you put your own slant on it and a bit of a spin, they really appreciate the joke. They get it and they find the humour in that. I think that's why Roald Dahl's Revolting Rhymes are particularly popular as well.
Well, it's obviously you enjoy writing and,
and
you're good at it. Would you ever consider writing an adult novel?
I would definitely consider it one day, perhaps. At the moment, I'm having a ball writing children's books, and I think that's what I'd like to do at the moment. I think it's really great fun, and there's a lot of variety in there, as we've discussed, a lot of the deeper stuff for teens and the more fun stuff for the younger years. And I think maybe one day, never say never, but why not? I like to try new things all the time.
And what about a series of novels?
Oh, very much. I'm hoping, actually, that there will be a sequel to Momnesia. Keeping my fingers crossed for that, because I think that has a lot of scope for more fun and trouble and chaos in the future with Shazza and Lucy.
Because we talked to Jan Todd about letting go of her biography subjects, and I guess you must sort of feel similarly sometimes. You get very attached to your characters.
I do. It is hard to let them go sometimes. I think finishing a book anyway is very hard because you always want to make it better. Every time you read it, there's something else you can improve. But yeah, there are certain characters that become really good friends and you kind of want to stay with them and find out what happens next.
What happens next, yes, because they're at that kind of cusp in their life, lots of
absolutely,
them, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what, given your gift, I think, for dialogue and your background in drama, would you ever consider writing a screenplay?
Definitely. I wrote a screenplay when I was at university, in fact, and I'd love to get into screenwriting, writing for TV dramas. Maybe one day I'll write something and then act in it. That would be the dream come true.
There you are. You're the full package, aren't you? But it seems to me things like Tracy Beaker, they almost take on a different life of their own, and readers or young people come to them at different ways. So somebody might not know Tracy Beaker through the books, for example, see the TV series and then go back to them. It's quite a nice symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely. And with films as well, like The Hunger Games, both like the films can breathe new life to the books give a different perspective on the films or the TV programme. I think it's a really interesting dynamic.
What's the one book when you were growing up that you remember?
Peter Pan.
Really?
Yes, Peter Pan was my all-time favourite book when I was growing up. Just the magic of it, the idea that one day Peter Pan might fly through my window and take me to Neverland. It's never left me. That's my secret dream.
That's interesting, isn't it? The boy who never grew up, and here you are writing for teens.
Yes,
you
have grown
up clearly.
Me,
no, you have. But you're also, you know, still very embedded in young people's lives.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's very true.
So what next for you?
At the moment, I'm trying something new again. I'm writing some early readers, some reading scheme books for even younger children. So it's sort of helping kids learn to read. And that's proved a different challenge in a way, and also a different joy, in that you have a very select group of words you can use and to make a story out of those and bring it to life and make it interesting for the kids as they're learning to read. I think that's really valuable and really tricky, and it's been a great challenge.
I was going to say very challenging.
Absolutely.
Perhaps makes you think about your own writing as well in a different way. You go back to a wider vocabulary with joy.
Yes, absolutely. And also it makes you think about your word choice a lot more, I think. It's very specific.
And we ask all our guests this. What are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading? I'm actually rereading some classics. I've just reread The Wizard of Oz, which was enlightening because I don't think I'd actually ever read it in the first place. I'd just seen the film, and it's very different from the film. Which
is it?
Yeah. The slippers aren't red, for one thing.
What?
I know, they're silver. So it's always read the book, kids. Don't just watch the film. So there we go.
But this was, when was that written? Sort of 1910, something like that?
Yeah, a long time ago.
So, and was that aimed at young?
Yes, absolutely. It was written to be sort of a modern day fairy tale at that time, to sort of take the elements of the Grimm tales, but put them in a slightly safer form in Oz, in a way. But yeah.
Interesting what young people were reading then.
Absolutely.
Compared to, you know, fast forward 100 years or so.
Yeah, although it's not that different, really, to sort of the Percy Jackson thing, is like with normal kids get taken off into a magical world, or Harry Potter. It's a very similar concept in a way, so we've not changed that much in some ways.
Well, Kate, it's been lovely talking to you today. We're going to come back to you in just a moment to find out your final choice of music, which is lovely. I can't wait to play out on this one. But yes, we've been talking about Neverending Birthday today, which is published by Macmillan. As I say, this is the last in the present series of Bookmark, but we will be back. Our next show is on September the 9th, and in between now and then, we'll be replaying some of our favourite bookmarks from the last series. But that first show, our studio guest will be World Fantasy Award-winning short story writer and poet Helen Marshall. We'll also be hearing from performance poet Harry Baker, and travel writer and novelist Jane Wilson-Howarth will be talking to us too. If you are pining for us, remember that on our website, the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.co.uk, all the podcasts from all the bookmarks ever, which go back 3 or 4 years, they're up there if you're looking for something to do over the summer. But do have a good summer. We will see you again in September. Now, we're playing out with this track, which is from the Muppet Movie. It's Life's a Happy Song. Why this one?
I just think this has to be one of the best mood-lifting songs ever. I played it every morning when I was going through a tricky phase writing my book, and it just put me in a good mood and made me smile, and who doesn't love the Muppets?
Everything is grand. I got the whole wide world in the palm of my hand. Everything is perfect. It's falling into place. I can't seem to wipe this smile off my face. Life's a happy song, and there's someone by my side to sing along. When you're alone, life can be a little rough. It makes you feel like you're 3 foot tall. When it's just you, well, times can be tough. When there's no one there to catch your fall.